One of the things that I find fascinating is that so few people seem to understand the dynamic that is at play when they access a website for free or download an app for free. They think it's for free, but really they're paying for it with their data. I think a lot of people do not appreciate that and don't realize that.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to Regulating AI, the podcast that brings together diverse global voices to discuss fair and responsible AI regulation worldwide. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are thrilled to have two distinguished guests from the state of Vermont, who are at the forefront of AI and data privacy legislation. Joining us are Attorney General Charity Ray Clark and Vermont State Representative Monique Priestley. Attorney General Clark has been with the Vermont Attorney General's office since 2014, serving in various roles, including Chief of Staff. And Representative Priestley brings over two decades of technology experience and is the Executive Director of Space on Main, a nonprofit community workspace. Together, they have been instrumental in passing a stringent Data Privacy Act and working on potential AI legislation. Welcome, Charity, and welcome, Monique, to the Regulating AI podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Wonderful. Well, we have a global audience. Our audience is made up of members of Congress, Senate, their staff, think tank experts, AI enthusiasts, and these are people around the world. You've been able to do something that very few people have, both of you. Charity, can you give us an overview of Vermont's new Data Privacy Act and what prompted its creation?
This is a bill, not an act at this point, because while it passed the House and Senate, the governor did veto the bill ultimately, and it failed to override in the Senate. But of course, we'll be back in January with an even better bill, no doubt. And I'm really proud of the work being done. And really, I will say that I think the journey that this bill has been on is a lesson in itself of how to pass such a bill, because in its journey, a lot of education takes place, a lot of understanding. And while the landscape continues to change as the years pass, I think that the journey that the bill has been on has really activated people who learn about data privacy. And the more they understand, the more interested they are in passing a bill like this, which is what we saw in the House. Monique sits on the committee that voted this bill out, created this bill, and then voted it out unanimously because all the people on there received the education that would activate anybody about data privacy and some of the perils and what state legislatures and potentially Congress really should be doing. So I would love to defer to our representative who actually wrote the bill and is responsible for it in describing a little bit about it, about what it does. Monique, do you want to say a little bit more? I'm sure you could do it better than I can.
Thank you. Yeah, so this was my first term. And during our first year, we had a kind of a comprehensive data privacy bill that Charity A.G. Clark and her office submitted. And it was really the first time that I had dealt with consumer protection laws. And given my background in tech, like, it was something that I was trying to figure out, what is my role in the building? And so this was an area where I felt very comfortable with at least like the base concepts of what we were talking about. And I really wanted to take a role of trying to help with like all of the really technical pieces of the bill moving forward. So we didn't move the bill out of committee in 2023. We decided to take some more time on it. And so over the summer, I had reached out to Senator James Baroni in Connecticut, who had written a privacy bill that our committee wanted to use as like a starting point. And we had a conversation of, why did you do certain provisions in this? Did you take it as far as you wanted to? What would you do if you could do it all over again? What's your advice to me, to our committee? And so he really helped connect kind of like where he went with it, with his Privacy Act as it went forward, including things like they added consumer health protections and minor youth protections, which we started with all of that. And then also he just connected me to this whole network that had been helping advise the bill And that network just continued to grow. And going into 2024 in January, like, it wasn't just me, it wasn't just our committee, it was also experts from around the country and around the world that were having input on red lines, but also lobbying efforts and things like that. So it was a real collaboration with the Attorney General's office, as well as attorney generals across the United States, other legislators, law professors, tech compliance lawyers, privacy advocates, and everything in between.
Wow, that sounds like a very important collaboration that you did. Charity, you had mentioned in an opinion piece that this bill creates mechanisms for data minimization. Can you elaborate on how this works and why is it important for our audience?
Well, let me first say that my office is the recipient of all the notices people give when there has been a security breach. And the Data Breach Notification Act, or the Security Breach Notification Act, was established in Vermont 16 years ago, I think. And, you know, even little Vermont, we get at least one notification a day. It's a couple, really, on the average, a day, depending on the year. And so for many organizations and companies, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. Long story short is we also, in addition to those notifications, receive a lot of calls from businesses saying, we had a breach, but here's the information we had. And it's like not on the list of things you have to report. And they're like, do we really not have to report this? And we want to say, congratulations, you did data minimization. No, you don't have to report it. And likely your customers or whoever else was in your database are not having their privacy or their financial security or physical security compromised in any way because you deleted the data or you didn't ask for the data and you used the data for the reason you said you were going to use it for, but you got rid of it or whatever. You didn't hold data in certain places either. So really, the data minimization provision of this bill was a codification of best practices we all should be doing. And again, Monique probably can remember all the details. It was inspired by legislation that had already taken place in other states. So it was not reinventing the wheel for those data holders who would need to comply. We certainly wanted to make it easy for them. But this is just a real common sense provision, in my opinion.
Yeah. So when we started with Connecticut, but then after talking to a number of different states and privacy advocates, it was clear that we really didn't have data minimization by using the base Connecticut model. And so by talking to other states, really actually Maine and Massachusetts were taking a strong stance on data minimization at the same time that we were working on our bill. So largely, we were really trying to be in line with those states. And then as negotiations went forward and we were needing basically on the Senate side, they were tending to have the industry kind of have them water down and weaken the bill. And in order to account for some of the areas that things had been weakened, we actually made certain areas like data minimization stronger. And towards the end, we actually based that minimization piece off of Maryland, which instead of minimizing the use of data once you have it, it minimizes the collection of data as it comes in. So at the very root of the problem when companies are collecting data.
That's great. The Data Privacy Act also includes specific protections for children. Can either of you talk about some of these provisions and why they are crucial?
I can talk about the provisions that are related to social media. My office has sued Meta for harms that they perpetuated against children with the app Instagram, and that includes creating a harmful app that's addictive, but also the content that children are exposed to and unwanted contact from strangers and several other components. So the language of that portion of the bill was inspired in part by the experience that we had, the investigation that we had in our ultimate lawsuit against Meta and what we've learned in the process. We're also investigating TikTok, who unfortunately have some of the same ills as Instagram, so far as we can tell at this point. So it reflects that work that was done. And I think that it's an acknowledgement. I'll tell you something, Sanjay. In my travels here in Vermont, the legislative session has ended. My attention can leave Montpelier a little bit more robustly and making my way around the state. I would say that the issue that I hear about the most is this issue that I sued Meta. You know, thank you, Charity, for taking this stand. And I hear from parents and teachers, and they realize the concerns are very visceral to them, those who work with children. And of course, what we know is that data is what's fueling social media, and these issues are connected. Anyway, wanted to highlight that. I think it's really important. But Monique, maybe you can speak to some of the other provisions too.
Yeah, definitely. So there was a kind of a two-part piece to the minor protections. So in the Data Privacy Act that we were taking Connecticut as a model, they had minor provisions. We actually ended up swapping for Colorado towards the end, but because that had been continued to work on Connecticut. In those data protections, it really was getting at basically just protecting people's data. And it was giving heightened risk kind of like to minor protections. And then at the same time, we had the kids code piece of things that was going after how is data used to affect kids adversely. And a critical piece here is that those two bills, so kids code and the Privacy Act with their minor provisions, were moving together at the same time, but it was clear they could never coexist. They were contradicting each other. So a lot of towards the end, as far as political navigation, we had to marry those into one comprehensive bill. And what we did towards the end, I actually really appreciated. I spent 3 full days of legislative council to take all of the data, anything that had to do with data itself, out of the kids code and move it over to the Comprehensive Data Privacy Act where it should be, like, and then keep the kids code piece really at like how is the data being used to manipulate and nudge and keep people addicted and stuff. But I think that the bigger lesson for me on the data piece is that it is attractive politically to protect, to say we're protecting kids, but everyone of every age should be afforded privacy protections. And if we're protecting everybody, we are protecting kids. So the thing for me is, yes, we have kids protections, but we want to make sure that no matter what age anybody is, especially even thinking about the most vulnerable, like elderly people who are getting love scammed and things like that, we need to really think about a lot of states were just copying each other's privacy policies over and over, which is like how things work. But we need to like do the due diligence to think about at a fundamental level, why do we want data collected? Like, why are we basing our entire world's business on data? And then do we want to be responsible with it? And if we want to be responsible with it, maybe we don't. Maybe we just want to make money. Hopefully we want to be responsible. But what does that mean? And who does that mean? And are we leaving people out with our policies? And so that's, for me, it came to, we can't leave anybody out of any age.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, Monique. You can't leave, because as you said, there are vulnerable populations in every segment. And I'm going to come down to that later when we talk about AI. But Charity, I made a mistake. We have a global audience. I want you to tell them what is the Attorney General's office, because we take it for granted that everybody knows, and I should have upfront, because they are probably scratching their head, because you mentioned you sued Meta, you want to do the same to TikTok. So please, just a very brief idea of what AG's office does.
So the Attorney General is an elected official in a state. Every state has one, although not in every state are they elected here in the United States. And in short, we're the lawyer to the state. So sometimes that means we're just reading the state's contracts or whatever. We also give it to the legislature, of course, but we can bring lawsuits on behalf of the state. And that could look simply someone put a toxic waste dump in their backyard and they can't do that. So we use environmental laws to sue that person. But in this context, we're talking about, as Monique referred to, a consumer law. And the Consumer Protection Act is a powerful act here in Vermont and nationally. It's when you protect consumers, you protect the marketplace. And especially in the United States, we are a capitalist country and the marketplace is incredibly important. So we take it really seriously. And of course, that is where I came from in the Attorney General's office. That's where I started. So I myself am a consumer lawyer. And so no surprise, I am very passionate about data privacy because, as we know, consumer transactions so largely take place today online, and online is fueled by data. And so it's a fundamental piece of our current marketplace in 2024. This is just life. But what's setting aside the policy issues, it's also fascinating in many respects. One of the things that I find fascinating is that so few people seem to understand the dynamic that is at play when they access a website for free or download an app for free. They think it's for free, but really they're paying for it with their data. I think a lot of people do not appreciate that and don't realize that. And one of the things that Monique and I do in our work on this issue is we try to educate. And I truly am concerned that if we don't take seriously the regulation of data, including deepfakes, there is going to be a destabilizing impact on the internet economy because consumers aren't going to trust when they buy something, when they buy a service, that it's real. Or they're going to be nervous to, you know, share their data because they're nervous about becoming a victim of identity theft and having their money stolen or whatever. And we all remember robocalls, right? And how it used to be someone would call you and say, would you like to buy some steaks or whatever? And you might say yes. And then scam robocalls took over. And now no one buys anything over the phone. And we don't even answer our phones. I don't answer my phone. I just let it go to voicemail. If I want to call the person back, I will. So I don't want that to happen to the internet. And I always will point that out to people that when you protect consumers, you protect the marketplace too.
So you raised some important points here, Charity. You talked about consumer protection. You talked about picking up the phones. You also talked about deepfakes, and this is something you've talked a lot about. We are in an election time in our country right now, and there have been elections in other parts of the world, France, UK, etc. What can states do about deepfakes? And you saw what happened in the primary, I think it was in Connecticut with President Biden and things of that nature. What are your views on deepfakes as far as the, and now with AI, it's so easy for people to produce deepfakes. Charity, what is your office doing or what are your views on this?
Well, first I want to make a distinction between a legitimate company doing something that might violate the Consumer Protection Act. You know, that would be in my case against Meta, right? They are very legitimate company doing something that we're saying in our lawsuit violates the Consumer Protection Act. In contrast to actual criminals who are scammers and they're trying to steal things or trick you, and that's a different category. So fakes, I would put in that category where people are trying to trick you in some fashion. And I can see three examples. You gave the political example, which is critical and chilling. There's also the consumer example. Remember, there was a couple of people, scammers, who were trying to say, oh, this is Taylor Swift or another celebrity, and they're selling this or giveaway. That's in the consumer context, in the scam context. And then, of course, supposedly 90% of deepfakes are actually non-consensual deepfake pornography. 90% is a very high number, and also disturbing that this really incredible technology is being used for this purpose is incredibly disappointing and sad. And also, it's very gendered because 90% of those 90% are women. The faces of women are being used in this way. Very offensive, very upsetting. And the New York Times recently called an epidemic among teen girls. I'm the first woman elected attorney general here in Vermont. And I'm always looking through that lens of what am I seeing that no woman has seen before, you know, through my experience and what I can notice. And so I have really focused on deep fakes for a number of reasons. They're right here in my wheelhouse, but I'm really concerned about the ways that these are being used to hurt people. You asked me about the political use of deepfakes, so I want to make sure I answer that question. I really feel at this point, when it's so new, deepfakes are so new, it's important for people to be educated and know that what they're seeing might not be real. Because there are so few regulatory guidelines in place that are helping to educate the public. And I think we saw this in New Hampshire. Someone used deepfake technology to make a deepfake of President Biden's voice. And it's chilling. But immediately, a company was able to say, because there's also, of course, a market for deepfake identifiers, was able to say this is a deepfake. And that's really helpful. But educating the public, the press, and individuals, including voters, you know, don't be naive. This happened, I think, is really critical.
But Charity, is there a danger that we become so cynical that we don't believe anything anymore?
Well, that's kind of relates to my point about my concern about the internet marketplace, where consumers are so cynical, they don't think anything, like us with the phone. Like, no one could sell me anything over the phone. I would never buy it. I would be like, send me something via Pony Express. Like, I'm not buying it. So it's so ironic that we create these incredible technological tools, and then we revert. I'm literally getting a landline installed in my house because I don't want my kid getting a smartphone.
You're going back in time, Charity.
We're going back in time. So true.
But one of the things, Charity, that you have mentioned is the influence of big tech during your whole legislative process, that it was really, really hard Maybe both of you can address this for our audience, for other attorney generals and other governors who listen in to, who are trying to do some of these things, as to what are the lessons learned by both of you during this whole process? And you talked a lot about it. I've read some of the things you've said, Charity.
And Monique wrote an op-ed about this. I don't know, Monique, if you want to say a little bit about your observation, being the person who was in the thick of it being lobbied.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, lots of articles about this. So yeah, I think the thing is that first, I wanted to have conversations with lobbyists on all sides of the issue. So typically, some legislators will not, just won't talk to lobbyists because they don't want to be persuaded and manipulated. In my case, I want to hear both sides. So what we did so that our committee members wouldn't be inundated with manipulation and persuasion and tactics is that we've basically everybody would defer and say, you have to talk to Monique about this. I'm not talking about it. So it meant that I had a flood of funneled lobbyists coming my way. And what I do, so I sat down with any lobbyist and any lobbyist clients that wanted to talk. And I started forming like the same questions over and over. I just turned into like more or less a form email that I would say, I need you to answer these six questions. Once you answer those questions, or you don't, but you at least attempt to have a good faith response to it, then we'll sit down and we'll talk through it. And some of those questions, which I'm actually putting together basically an anti-lobbying playbook with some national groups. So any of the things I mentioned that anybody who's listening wants to go over, I'm putting into a resource. So that would be, the questions would be something like, you say you have a problem with this bill. What are the business cases that you are saying this bill interrupts? What is the exact verbiage in line that you are saying does this? What would you propose that we change this line to? And then really, I actually asked them to talk through the ramifications of the change they were proposing. If they were asking for an exemption, then I wanted to know, prove that other states have done this exemption. And if they haven't, then probably out of luck. But if they have, let's talk about it. And so that was a big chunk of things. But when we were in our committee, another thing that we did is, so I was, anytime a lobbyist had a question, I would go to 20 different people and I would, from all sides of the spectrum of pro do with the regulations, privacy advocacy, to the compliance lawyers who are actually trying to help the tech companies navigate this. And so I could, and everything in between, so I could get a good spectrum of what's realistic. And I would have calls with people offline and say, they want this change. What does this change actually do? Tell me the worst and best case that this does. And so it was constant education on me. And then I was redlining the documents myself. So I was always in there getting lessons and making the changes. And then I did study committees. So we avoided quorums of our committee members, but we would have dinners where it's four of us would go and have pizza and we'd take 3 hours and we'd walk through every single line of the bill. And then I do the next four committee members. We do the same thing. And we did that over and over. Every single draft, our committee, I wanted them to know, because the biggest kind of attack point for lobbyists is to go after the people who don't seem to understand what the bill is doing and cause disruption and cause questions in the public. And so our committee is solid. Lobbyists gave up on our committee like 3 weeks before it left. The bill was voted out, basically saying like they couldn't make headway. And they just said to me, they said, we'll see you in the Senate. Basically, good luck. We give up on you, but we're going to kill it in the Senate. And I went to the Senate initially to try to help. That kind of got shut down by lobbyist pressures. The Senate faced a lot of pressures there and they caved. And in that case, lobbyists continued to send emails to the big kind of groups like CCC and SPSC and that kind of stuff. They were national lobbyist interests that were working through local trade associations like the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, Vermont Retail and Grocers Association, entities like that, Ski Association. And so they would have those entities mass email all of their members and their customers and basically say that you need to tell your legislators to kill this bill, or this bill will kill targeted advertising, or this bill will kill the internet, is one of the things that was said. And so in each of those cases, I would get forwarded those emails from people, and then I would write rebuttal documents. So if it was like, this bill will keep people from being able to, small businesses from being able to advertise the blue shirts or a sale that they have upcoming. And so then I would work with that whole range of experts who were on the team in the backgrounds, and we would just write rebuttal responses, and I would send it to every single member of the body. So all the senators, all the House members, all of leadership, and say, here's the 20 things they claimed. here's the 20 responses to that. It doesn't do anything that they're saying. And so that just happened over and over and over again. Yeah, I guess that was the big thing. And then they came out in full force again, not like after the Senate passed it, they came out in full force to the governor as well. So moving forward, we know now the timing of all of these different attacks and the substance of each of these different attacks and even amendments. You know, some companies would come in and even the word is being swapped in for something else that can dramatically change the impact of a bill. So we have basically a resource where we're documenting like what were all the amendments that were requested. What are the ramifications of the amendments and the words being requested? Because it's not just us. It's happened in all of the different states in one form or another, the same thing, the timing, rebuttals to things. So we're just putting that all in a resource for other people who are trying to pass privacy legislation.
So for our listeners, if you are trying to pass privacy legislation, Monique has put together a tried and true resource book. That's fantastic. Monique, you have a long background in technology. When you look at AI, artificial intelligence, which is, according to most people, it's going to be the revolutionary technology of our time. What concerns you about AI, that the concerns that need regulation? We have an executive order from President Biden. There have been over 100 bills, more than 100 bills that have been initiated in Congress. Unfortunately, we have a Congress right now where we can't get anything done. But talk about your concerns from a state standpoint or just overall standpoint.
Yeah, sure. And I think the data privacy work itself has really, this was a new space for me, and the artificial intelligence space is a new space for me. But setting the base with privacy and just thinking about the ways that like people are collecting and using data in general without our knowledge most of the time, or just ignorance, basically, like not paying attention or not knowing the ramifications. That's, and even at a base level, fair and deceptive use of data. There's a lot of ground level stuff. If you get into deepfake, thinking about what goes into a deepfake and thinking about biometric protections and things like that. I think at a base level, the data is most concerning to me, because then when you layer artificial intelligence on top of it, then you are able to automate and like exponentially speed up the poor uses and dangerous uses of data. So for me, the artificial intelligence pieces are thinking about real world examples of what terrifies me, is things like if we're talking about people being able to use data to make discriminatory decisions on people, for instance, if you're trying to get a loan or if you're trying to get a job or housing or anything like that. And then you think about people using artificial intelligence, like automated engines, to then magnify that, multiply that, so that it's just constantly happening without even any humans being involved in the process. That's really scary. Like, how do you interrupt? How are you able to defend yourself? How are you even able to know as a human that is happening to you, that you're being discriminated against? The discrimination, the bias piece, also just thinking a lot of this, like I've been following so many different people on LinkedIn in the privacy and artificial intelligence space, and really just thinking about the fact that we, when it comes to this, we no longer, at least in the United States, at least in Vermont, we don't teach ethics anymore. We don't teach philosophy. And really what it comes down to is, what do we value as a human being, like as what makes us human, and the autonomy that we want over how we operate in the world and how the world kind of interacts with us. And so the artificial intelligence piece to me is so fascinating, because it's just that on steroids. It's, what do we want for our future and the way that we live and interact with the world? And so it really just gets to those ethical and philosophical questions of, what are we doing here? How do we want to be interacted with in our economy? Yeah.
I was just going to enthusiastically echo that. That is what I come back to that all the time, that this really is ethical questions. And it's not just how AI is being used, but how AI is being developed. If I'm unethically training an AI, can someone ethically use that AI if copyrighted works, for example, have been used to educate that, to train that AI? So what you say really resonates with me. And I think it is value statements. And when it comes to data, it's similar. We allow corporations to surveil us in a way that we would never allow a government, but then the government can buy the surveillance data from the corporation. It's just, it's chilling. And here in Vermont is a very rural place. It's also very small. Everything's on the human scale. Everybody knows each other. Between the two of us, Monique and I, literally, I'm sure we know 80% of everyone in Vermont, like between the two of us. It's just a small place. There's only 640,000 people who live here. And for that reason, people value their privacy. It's kind of part of the ethos here. And they value just being able to be in the woods by themselves. We've all had that experience hiking or going to a state park or something. It's just a very rural place. And I think that the idea that people and corporations are surveilling us is chilling to Vermonters because we're used to having this kind of freedom and independent freedom. It's like right on the license plate. It's our state motto, freedom and unity. And I think that being free from corporate surveillance is a value that we have here in Vermont.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI, and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
Monique talked about biases, ethics, and you also have talked about a charity. The way the large language models, which is the ChatGPTs and others of the world work, is they ingest or they suck up a lot of the data that exists on the internet. Now, there have been some lawsuits by New York Times and others on OpenAI and others, but the data that they're sucking up is data that would have biases in there, because when you go on the internet, there's all kinds of opinions and views in there, and then there could be decision-making, but also there is the whole privacy issue. So when you look at artificial intelligence making those decisions and you look at your privacy bill, is there any issue that kind of you run up against? California is in the process of passing a big AI bill, and they're facing the onslaught that you faced, Monique, of corporate backlash. Because the big argument that corporates make, and I want to also have you address that, is innovation versus regulation. And that's the big question that happens, is that you talked about, we are a capitalist economy. We live on innovation. And some of these companies say, if you tie our hands too much, you're going to lose out on a lot of the innovation that drives this country, that creates the jobs, etc. So I would love for you both to address some of these issues that AI is being discussed about.
I think it's really critical for people to understand what a corporation is. A corporation is designed to make money for its shareholders. If it has failed to do that, it has failed as a corporation. They're not designed to be ethics professors or philosophy professors. And we can't fault them for not being that. But we also can't believe them when they say that they're doing things for anything other than earning money for their shareholders. That's what a corporation by design has to do. Anyone who took corporations in law school and is listening to this class, that's like, you know, week one of that class. So that's really important to have as a foundation, because it's critical to understand what their job is. And it's in contrast to our job as regulators, as public servants protecting people. And speaking of people, I also have said this before, we're in charge, not corporations. We are in charge. This is a government for the people, of the people, by the people, not for the big tech, of the big tech, and by the big tech. We're in charge. And we get to decide. I think that our laws should prioritize protecting us, protecting children, and not protecting the concept of innovation as framed by a corporation who's designed to make money for its shareholders and not necessarily designed to protect people from the potential unintended consequences, for example, of that. And I want to give you an example. Sanjay, you had talked about the bias built into some of the AI. There is a company advertising on Twitter, so I see it. I don't know how they picked me, but there it is. And they drive me crazy because they're trying to demonstrate that you can prompt the AI to provide a picture and it will provide a picture. Except the prompt keeps saying a girl wearing a pink dress in winter. And it produces a woman wearing a pink dress in winter. And it's driving me crazy because I don't say girl when I'm describing a woman. That is sexist. And so the fact that the AI doesn't know that, and instead of producing a girl, is producing a woman, it drives me nuts. I always screenshot it and then complain to a friend. Monique, I probably showed you a screenshot of how annoyed I am at this AI. So that's just a little example that I have had with and my use of Twitter.
Monique, your thoughts, innovation, regulation, ingesting all the data, you know how this whole thing works?
Yeah, I think I will start off with just kind of riffing off some examples from The Age of Surveillance Capitalism by Shoshana Zuboff and then Why Privacy Matters by Neil Richards. And like those two books recently I've been reading, and they equate what's happening right now with data privacy and with artificial intelligence to colonialism. And so thinking about land as being a resource that people come and they claim rights to, it doesn't matter who's being affected. They will, in that case, whoever's colonizing is saying they're going to make things better and offering a thing at the expense of whoever was on that land. And so they equate that to basically like, we are the land. Our data is the land. Who gets to decide that what of our data is up for grabs? How they're going to use the data, how the power dynamics of who owns the data and what that gets used for. And so that to me is horrifying. Like that is pure. We are looking at the more data you have, the more money you have, the more power you have, the more influence you have, the more you can manipulate human beings, thinking about all of the so things like data brokers. So for anybody that's listening, it doesn't matter if you go to Facebook and you use Facebook. If you go to a website, you have a device at all that is any way connected to the internet, there is somebody scraping, collecting the data of the angle your phone is at and who you're next to. And if it's a website, things we ran into after we started looking into things were you might be logging into your bank and think it's perfectly safe, or your healthcare provider and think it's perfectly safe. But if they have cookies and things like that installed on their websites that are then interacting, they may not be protected by any type of privacy login security features. So anything you're like doing, whether or not you realize and you think you're in a safe space, there are always cookies that are collecting as much data as they can. And those are being sold between large kind of like data holders or data brokers, of which there are thousands. I think the last count I heard from people in this space is that likely there's like 8,000 different data brokers operating in that kind of worldwide, 3,000 that tends to fit state examples of definitions of what that is. But they're just constantly selling our data, putting it at risk. And like the more data that a company has on us, they know our full personality. They know our psychological kind of like condition at a time. So they will use those to like target that. And also as Shoshana Zuboff goes up, the behavioral surplus of all of the information that we have can then be used to manipulate what we do, when we do it, who we do it with, why we do it, all that kind of stuff. So that is really getting to like, sounds conspiratorial, but like a type of mind control. Like we are being manipulated to do certain things at the whims of businesses trying to make money. That's horrifying. I am a techie. I love tech. I love innovation, but it has to be responsible and it has to be thinking about also how far are we going to take this and what is left when we are fully manipulating humans and at the whims of corporations, then what is being a human anymore, if not a robot to corporations' interests?
That's a very important point. Question for both of you. Should companies that are using AI in their products have a duty to disclose that they are using AI? Let's say whether it's for hiring or for loans or things of that nature, or making judgments or decisions. Is that something, what are your thoughts on that?
I would say that the range of AI is so dramatic. I don't think that you would want to exclude the use of AI. I mean, when you look at what AI is, it's like very basic things. I think what we're talking about is generative AI. And that to me is you've crossed over into an area that does cause me concern for a number of reasons, some of which we've talked about. So I do feel like there's a distinction between AI generally and then generative AI. And I'm interested to hear what Monique has to say.
Yeah, I agree with the distinction. But then I also, when it comes to automation, I do think that there should be disclosures, especially when we're starting to get into, being turned down for loans, being automatically one of my bills, H-114, was one that was, it was employee monitoring and automated decision making. So that was like, measuring whether or not the heat of whether or not I'm sitting in my chair, my retina scans of whether or not I'm reading my computer screen, whether or not I'm jiggling my mouse, whether or not I went to the bathroom and got off my chair. But something like an automated, if you add automation to that, and I get up for 10 minutes and go use the bathroom and come back, does an automated system that doesn't have a human in it anymore fire me and then not actually look into why? And so I think that in the very least, when people are signing up for services, when they are getting a job, when they're applying for a loan, they should know that there may be some automated type of decision-making happening, because there could be something. They need to have, basically, I think, a recourse for something happened. As Charity was saying, AI can't tell the difference between a girl and a woman. So can it decide between whether or not I got up for a certain reason or whether or not I actually left my job for a little while? So there needs to be, until I don't know where AI is going to be. I don't know where nobody knows fully where it's going to be. But there needs to be ways to interrupt and basically say, I think the wrong decision was made based on the criteria and the assessment that AI made. We have to be able to interject.
What Monique is kind of alluding to is now companies, because their workers are now working from home, companies have come up with a technology to figure out if your mouse is not moving, if you're actually working or not. And a lot of companies are implementing that technology. And you could argue either way for that. One of the things, and this is really for both of you, is when you look at creating legislation, let's just say that somewhere in the future you create AI bills or AI legislation, the technology is moving so fast. Today, if you look, Monique, you are a technology person. We started from large language models. Now you're into multimodal. You're now into agents, etc. How is policy going to keep up with how technology is? Charity, any thoughts? Monique, any thoughts in that?
I think education is critical. And one of the things that continues to surprise me is I think companies are asking for forgiveness and not permission, and they're trying to normalize the use of AI and the use of their collection of data before it alarms us. They're trying to just normalize it. I recently bought a car. I have had the same car for 10 years, so my old car is not very high tech. And I bought a new car, and I've been so irritated because it beeps all the time at different stuff. And I tried to download the app, and it told me, and of course, because I read the privacy disclosure, a lot of people probably don't. And it said, we're going to collect your data and we're going to do whatever we want with it. And I was very annoyed. And I went to chat to say, I don't want this. How do I avoid it? And the chat was like, here's the privacy policy. And I had to once again agree to disclosing all of my data. And so I have to call them and complain. And then I tried to hook up my phone to my car, and it was like, oh, well, you don't have Siri on. And I was like, well, of course I don't have Siri on. I'm a data privacy advocate. And they won't let me use the system. And so here I bought this new car, and my ability to take use of the amenities that are supposed to be included in my fancy car, my fancy new car, I'm being deprived of them because I'm not able to use them without compromising my data privacy, which I'm not willing to do. And the idea that this has been so normalized that I'm having this experience, but probably most people are just like, oh, okay, and allowing their data privacy to be handed over to a company you literally purchased a car from. What could be more expensive than a car? And yet they still are trying to get your data for free. I find it really troubling. So I am going to call them. I'm going to get around to doing that. I'll report back when I do. But I think they're trying to normalize it. And it's really up to us to educate legislators, the public, media, about what this might look like and what the implications could be, so that we can, as Monique so eloquently put, like, disrupt and just check in and say, how are we benefiting from this? Because so far, what I have seen is people making money is the big benefit, and the rest of us have some fun making a limerick at someone's retirement party using ChatGPT. But really, I would rather have my data be my own and have my privacy than have the limerick. And I continue to marvel. I know I sound like our esteemed senior senator, Bernie Sanders, but I continue to marvel that all the decades of technological advancement, and we're not working less, we're working more. And there's more poverty and less housing. And what's the point of the technology other than to make money for certain people if we're not all benefiting from this? And I hope that we're on the horizon of an era of AI where we're going to get to, you know, work less and enjoy more and be healthier and be happier. But I have to admit, I have my cynicism at this point in the juncture of our journey with AI.
Monique, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think for me, it's like a hard balance because of all of the lobbying interests. Like the more likely you are to get a bill, I think what we're seeing right now against big tech is to have multiple states run the same policy. So the plans for kind of AI is like 10 or so states running this more or less the same policy together. But in that case, I don't know that we can get it as strong as we need to in any unified way, because every state is going to face different degrees of lobbying efforts depending on who's really in their state in a lot of ways. But at the same time, so like anything that I do, like I'm still going to continue to run by as many people as possible in the background in the space, and also start to bring in more ethicists and things like that, like people who are understanding that that's important for me. But I also, it would be nice to be able to almost slow down or not continue to repeat the same policies that were written in large part by tech, by like Amazon workers and stuff like that. Workday is writing some AI policies from what I heard. So thinking about at a basic level, this is why the privacy policy was so important to me, is in getting to a root level of things like discrimination and data and things like that could happen at a more fundamental level than in an AI policy. And also things like looking at the underlying Fair and Deceptive Uses Act in the Consumer Protection Act. There, we are using AI and all of the mechanisms that are used, absorbing the data and using the data. But at a fundamental level, there are roots there of basic expectations of business and things like that. And I think we're largely ignoring safe protections of like even privacy. Like if somebody walked into our house, we would say that is an invasion of privacy. But then we have Alexas and we have Siri devices and we have everything else. We have smart cameras, we have smart fridges. So there were Roomba is like cataloging more couches. So I think the public is, including myself, I have since gotten rid of quite a few devices, of quite a few apps off my phone. I have disconnected my car app, things like that. But the average public does not realize, one, that they're not protected. They think they're protected. And two, they don't realize that no matter what they do, somebody is getting that to sell it. And I think, like Charity said, basic consumer education, I think, would go a long way. And then also just thinking at a fundamental level, what do we actually value as a population? And trying to figure out, like, how do we stop things from getting away at the earliest kind of basic level in policy?
I think that's a great point. Charity, Monique, for our global listeners who have asked this question, EU was able to pass GDPR. The United States is the big technological power. We still don't have a federal privacy act. And recently, Congresswoman Kathy Morris-Rogers, and they tried to, but I understand that also has been shelved. Why is it that we've not been able to do some of these things, which others have been able to do it? I mean, when privacy, you look at your state, as you said, privacy is very important. And I'm sure it's important in other states. Vermont can't be an outlier. But why is that? That's one of the questions that came for you.
Yeah, I think a few different things here. So out of the top 20 economies of the world, the United States is the only one without a universal countrywide policy, which is it's terrifying. That just seems super broken. And yeah, it is. I think it's a few things. One, it's absolutely money and power. Like all of the entities that we have that we're talking about, they are based in the United States. So we're on home turf trying to have that war. I also think in some cases, when we started getting into the policy pieces and trying to think about GDPR, in some ways, and I'm not saying I'm anti-First Amendment, but the First Amendment does have a weird rift where if we're trying to do protections, we're often coming up to that. And then we're also coming up to what a corporation say falls under free speech. So things like, you know, a lot of companies are claiming that code itself falls under free speech. So there is some weird mechanisms there that are pretty hard to navigate. And also just, I think in general, our population is just we're not talking about privacy enough. We're not talking about the cost of operating in America in general, where we expect everything to be easy and we expect everything to be quick on our smartphones and convenience, I feel like. And we need to talk about the cost of convenience and the cost of what we're giving up by interacting with so many businesses on a given day. And again, not coming up out against those, I am a fan of all of the tech, but we need to start talking about the cost to our humanity.
I think the other thing that we have in this country is we're very entrepreneurial, and we never want to squelch innovation. America has invented a lot of cool stuff, and we have been on the vanguard of innovation. And I think we're proud of that. It's part of kind of the fabric of who we are. And so no one likes the idea of pumping the brakes, but I think finding that balance is so critical. And what we have not had, as you have rightly pointed out, is federal involvement on regulating this. I have hope that could happen. I will say I'm always very nervous because Vermont, with other laws that we have, although this bill did not become law, I think it will be eventually a law. And I don't want some watered down version of what we have or what California has or Connecticut or Illinois. I want a robust bill. So it makes me uneasy. I think a national standard is better to comply with. It involves certainly educating the general public, but it also, I have a sense of uneasiness because I want to make sure that it's robust and appropriate. And one of the benefits to people of having this patchwork quilt in the United States is that every state gets to pass a bill that reflects its own values, which might be different from a state 3,000 miles away.
Yeah. And I think the point you're making is it's the impact of money, and it's the impact of maybe the public is not as aware, like maybe in Vermont, the public is, as you said, they value their privacy a lot. Talking about this for both of you, you saw what has happened in social media, Charity. You talked a lot about that. It's become the dominance of 5-6 companies, whether it's the Metas, etc. The big fear right now is the same thing is about to happen with AI, because it takes a lot of money, a lot of these expensive chips that you have to train. It costs literally hundreds of millions of dollars to produce a foundation model. And it is getting consolidated into these companies that first they control our social media, our town square. Now they could control this. Are there things that can be done? And now I'm talking to you as a state level, not specifically at a Vermont, but at a state level, that you think can prevent something like this from happening. And this is for our listeners outside also that have raised this question about about this AI monopoly that's about to happen.
I have been, like I say, some of this is very concerning to me, but some of it is fascinating. So I have been fascinated by the rush to roll out not ready for prime time products. And things going wrong, and you think about things going wrong with brands you've never heard of, but when Google has a disaster, you're thinking, I can't believe this. This is terrible. It's almost comical to see how eager everyone is to own the market, to be the big player so that they can get there first. So I think that needs to be said. And maybe now is the time to say it. It's like, yeah, we're eager to regulate them. But at the same time, they're obviously racing to perfect their product. So while we're racing, Monique and I are racing to educate people and act in Vermont, I think the products really aren't quite there yet. And that's going to have an impact too, because people are going to be reluctant once they try a product and an AI model and they don't like it, or they have a bad experience, or it becomes a joke, then they're not going to have the consumer confidence to use it. So I want to begin by just saying that. In terms of what can be done, we, Monique and I, in approaching this, have felt that there needs to be a foundation on data privacy first. And if your state is lacking that foundation on regulating data privacy, it's trickier to layer on AI. And what does AI mean? And frankly, part of that is because there needs to be an education about data and why data is important. I mean, that needs to happen first before I think the AI is meaningful, or not that it can't be meaningful, but I think it's going to be a cleaner process, because people will already have that knowledge of how the internet works and all of that, and be themselves curious. Because that's how I think Monique and I got here, is we're both very curious people. And so we think about what the implications are. AI, it's every day I come up with a new potential implication for AI that I hadn't thought of the day before. And it is really fascinating. And I, like Monique, I'm reading books too that I find it so interesting. So I don't know, maybe Monique has a cleaner example of the way that she thinks we can lead in this space.
I mean, it's curious, out of cynical off the cuff, can we interrupt tech monopolies? I am not sure. But something that happened recently with the EU AI Act, there were certain features that Meta said it was not going to run in the EU because it's running into the law. So that for me is a flag of, oh, what is red flag of what is EU blocking Meta from doing basically probably safely, responsibly. And if enough states, enough countries around the world were to like do that disruptive thing that the EU just did, they would have to figure something else out, right? But we have to collaborate state to state. We have to collaborate country to country. This is a global thing. And each of us, I think one thing I've seen is people will say, and even myself, that Vermont can't actually interrupt anything in the United States. It's such a small state. But we did. It was a big press piece to have a private right of action. And I'm learning, we were basing our laws off precedents about what other states were doing. And that's powerful. Like, as soon as you have one state that did it, then it kills a lobbyist's arguments of nobody's doing this. You're the first one. You can't do this. No, but that state did it. So I do think that little by little, as long as people are coordinating and collaborating and working off of each other, there is power in that. And I think that we are too siloed in so many ways. And if we just start talking, I think there's a lot of power in teamwork.
So she talked about power and teamwork. Charity, are other AGs around the country concerned about some of the same things you are concerned about with AI?
Yeah, definitely. In states, the attorneys general are the ones who enforce consumer protection laws. And this is very clearly a consumer issue. And we also sort of all have this, like I'm a mom and I sometimes refer to myself as like mama bear, where I'm always feeling like I'm protecting the people of Vermont, especially children, but I'm protecting everybody. It's just, that's my instinct. And a lot of AGs have that same kind of ethos. And so when they see something like this, their instinct is to protect. And we have consumer laws, we have antitrust laws, to the extent that there's an illegal monopoly that we won't hesitate to enforce. That's why we were elected. And I'm proud to be the person doing that work. The other thing I wanted to flag is that consumers themselves are very powerful. And one of my sisters says she votes with her fork and she votes with the food she buys. That's what how she expresses her values. And consumers do that too. At some point, if you make a product that's not desirable, people aren't going to buy it. Or if you make a product that they might like, but is tainted in some way with some history. I mean, we've all seen that. No one wants to buy it because the brand isn't cool or it's diminished in some capacity. So I think that's another part of the puzzle, is making sure that consumer behavior is kept in mind and consumer awareness is part of the conversation. Because I think that consumers themselves, they're the ones who are driving this and they can. The problem that we keep coming up on is the fact that consumers simply don't know that they're buying something. I'm doing air quotes here. They're buying something with their data. And when they're buying something with their money, they're aware of it. But when they're buying something with their data, they aren't aware of it. And to the extent that a company is screen scraping the internet for their data, for their photo or whatever, and using it to make money, and they're not getting any money, that always bugs me. Because what your listeners might not have picked up so far is that actually Monique and I are real advocates for small businesses. I grew up working in a small business. I'm the daughter, granddaughter, and great-granddaughter of small town Vermont grocers. I spent a ton of time working at my family's little grocery store in a ski town. And Monique is a champion in her town for small businesses. And part of the space on Main is the smallest businesses coming together to have a co-working space. So we actually are real corporate movers here in Vermont. And I think it's all very valuable and we want a marketplace that works, but that involves all of us having awareness. And I do resent, I'm more corporate friendly sometimes than I realize, but I do resent the idea that people are giving up their data, someone else is making money off of it, and they're not getting a cut. Can you imagine if someone grew carrots on my land, in my yard, sold the carrots at the farmer's market, and I never got a cut? right? That's anti our philosophy here in corporate America or capitalist world. So it doesn't seem to be functioning well. And I think part of it is because consumers don't really realize how things work.
So I think, Charity, you're making two very powerful points. Is consumer education is very important, and they can make a decision by the companies that they buy products from or they ignore if they don't share the values that they have. And the other point I think you're making is if their data is being used, they need a cut because it is their data and they need to have a financial piece of the action is what you're saying.
I mean, that's what I think is literally the baseline fundamental ethos of this whole bill and movement is that consumer data belongs to consumers. It's ours. And that's what this bill was trying to address and confirm and codify.
Well, that's fantastic. I could go on for an hour more because I have so many other, because the two of you mix, I'm sure there's a tremendous synergy with the two of you in terms of the yin and the yang. But we have some quick lightning round questions because I know you have busy things to do. So either one of you can pick up. Generally, we like you to pick up, answer one word. But in your case, because the AG is also online, we'll make an exception. Here we go. This is just a little fun stuff. To either of you, transparency or privacy, which one would you want?
Privacy.
Okay. Automation or human oversight?
Oversight.
Okay. Open source AI or proprietary AI, Monique?
Open source.
Okay. This is for either of you. National AI policies or international AI frameworks?
Dreaming big.
Okay. I like the flexibility, to be honest. I'm a federalist. I like the flexibility of having different approaches. And we learn all the time from, I'm saying way too many words. I was going to say, we learn a lot from Europe and other countries, and I like that. So that's my take.
Okay. Is AI a greater risk or is it an opportunity for society?
Opportunity.
Okay. Will AI increase or decrease economic inequality?
Well, it depends on how we regulate it.
It's all of these depend on how we regulate
it. Great answer. Great answer. Well, this has been fabulous. I really want to thank both of you for joining today and sharing your incredible insights on these crucial topics. You know, your work in Vermont really is serving as a beacon for other states and other regions grappling with the complex task of creating these very, very tough regulations. And to our listeners, the efforts of Attorney General Clark and Representative Priestley highlight the importance of proactive, thoughtful work in shaping the future of privacy, technology, and AI. And I think their work demonstrates that even at the state level, significant strides can be made in ensuring that technology development, AI, aligns with our values and protects our rights. As we conclude this session, really want to thank them both for the work that they're doing and really hope that we can have them back for a real fun-filled, informative session. Thank you, Charity, and thank you, Monique. It's really been fun.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.